Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Tuesday, Bradley Manning, the Army private convicted of leaking hundreds of thousands of classified documents to WikiLeaks, was sentenced to 35 years in a military prison. On the day after his sentencing, he announced in a letter that he wants to live as a woman and is now Chelsea. Most of the media coverage has shifted from Chelsea being a whistleblower and the details of the leaks to gender identity. Joining us to talk about coverage of this is Kevin Gostola. He's a reporter with Fire Dog Lake, and he's been covering Manning's trial since the very beginning. Hi, Kevin. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thank you.
Hey, nice to have you. And we're also joined by Protop Chatterjee, Executive Director of CorpWatch. Protop has been covering NSA funding. His latest piece focuses on Glimmer Glass. This is a Northern California company that sells optical fiber technology to government agencies. With so much focus on the NSA and the leaks, where is the coverage of the growing budget and the companies making money off of spying? Hi, Protop. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
Nice to have you. And on Wednesday, according to reports, over 1,000 Syrians were allegedly killed by chemical weapons. No one knows who did it or what exactly happened. So in a case like this, which is often the case when we're talking about Syria, how are journalists supposed to report this kind of tragedy? And how can they report when they cannot physically be in Syria? Martin Chulov has been covering this. He's Middle East correspondent with The Guardian, and he joins us from Cairo. Hi, Martin. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Good to be with you.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So Protop, why don't we start off with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I have to say that the best reporting by far of the year, including this week, has been The Guardian's reporting on the NSA. And you'll see a story actually went up just a couple of hours ago by Ewan McCaskill from The Guardian's D.C. office, I think. Bill Martin might correct me there. And he just reported on the fact that the NSA was paying companies like Google and Yahoo and Microsoft and Facebook to give them data under the FISA rulings. So I think that and the continued reporting, James Ball had a piece just a couple of days ago where he counted out the number of articles that The Guardian has printed in the last 2 months, I guess, which is 300 articles on the NSA scandal. So my kudos to The Guardian.
All right. And we'll talk about this later in the show, Protop. But do you have any idea how much the budget is now for the NSA?
Well, I know that the general intelligence budget, which covers all 17 agencies, is of the order of $80 billion, of which 70% goes to contractors.
Wow.
Off the top of my head, I'm not sure what the NSA budget is, though I think that's a published figure now.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll definitely talk more about that and the piece that you wrote about this company called Glimmer Glass. So kudos to The Guardian for its continued coverage of the NSA. And we'll also talk later in the show about Glenn Greenwald's partner, David Miranda, who was held for 9 hours by the British government. They took passwords, all of his equipment, and we'll talk about what that means for journalism. What about you, Kevin? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I have one example that I'll maybe raise later on of a fellow colleague who did good reporting on Manning. I'll hold off on that. And what I'll do is go to a McClatchy report that came out actually a week ago, but I'm not sure you would have had an opportunity to highlight it on your program, where Marissa Taylor and Cleve R. Woodson did more coverage of the polygraph issues with the government coming after polygraph instructors who might actually teach how you could beat a polygraph. This is quite a thing because it's part of the Obama administration's crackdown on leaks. And, you know, of course, the way that they want to try to catch leakers now is be able to do these polygraph exams on individuals. That's something we've learned quite a bit from the McClatchy organization. And now we're hearing that they would be willing to go so far as to possibly fire or retaliate against people who are giving polygraph beating advice, even though it just would make sense that if you're going to learn how to do polygraph exams, that you would know what to look for to see if someone was trying to beat your polygraph exam.
You know, we actually had Marissa Taylor on the show in the past, and we did try to get Marissa or Cleve Woodson on the show, but they weren't available. So we'll hopefully have them on in the next couple of weeks. But thank you for that. And is this getting much traction, Kevin?
That's particularly why I chose it, because this seems to be a very significant part of the Obama's efforts to go after and root out so-called insider threats, yet we're not really paying too much attention. And it'll get, this connects to the Bradley Manning story of these measures put in place after the disclosure of information to WikiLeaks to go after insiders.
And the lead in this piece says federal agents have launched a criminal investigation of instructors who claim they can teach job applicants how to pass lie detector tests as part of the Obama administration's unprecedented crackdown on security violators and leakers. So thank you for that. That's definitely undercovered. And we'll put a link on our website right after the show. That's Kevin Gostola with Fire Dog Lake. And Martin Chulov, what about you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I wouldn't normally talk about my own organization, let alone the editor-in-chief of the newspaper, but he burst into print this week for one of the very rare times over the last few years and wrote an incredibly compelling piece about his run-ins with the British government after the Snowden files were leaked to us. The piece that he wrote, Alan Rusbridge, the editor-in-chief, led into a stunning sort of sequence in which Guardian executives were taken down to the basement of the newspaper and ordered to destroy a couple of laptops and hard drives that contained all of the information that had just been brought back to the UK by Glenn Greenwald's partner, Dave Miranda, and destroy them with angle grinders and drills under the supervision of two officers from the GCHQ, which is Britain's equivalent of the NSA. So it was just an extraordinary piece of writing and some remarkable revelations. And it's the first time in a long time I've really just stopped in my tracks and gone back and read that power again and thought, did I really read that?
Wow. Can you give us a little background on this, Martin? Guardian editors revealed this on Tuesday about how they destroyed computer hard drives containing copies of some of the files leaked by Snowden.
Yeah, correct. A lot of these files had come to us over recent weeks and recent months. In those months, Alan Rusbridge had been contacted by two people at the heart of government. He didn't identify them, but one of them has identified himself subsequently, and he was the cabinet secretary of the UK government, so a direct report to David Cameron. He'd passed on to Rusbridge that the government were unhappy, that you guys have had your fun, we want our stuff back now. He said that the talks were cordial. They went on for a few weeks. They got a bit more steely as time wore on. They were never threatening until they got to a point where the government officials suggested that they would pursue legal action, which would have shut down the Guardian's reporting on Snowden, certainly in the UK. Rusbridge told them that we can report offshore. We can go to South America. We can go to the US, where the laws, a freedom of speech is protected by statute. And the British government knew this. The spooks knew it as well. And they seemed to be interested in symbolism more so than anything else. It wasn't, I would argue, a concerted effort to shut us down or to shut our reporting down. It was more so an effort just to get it offshore and away from us where it doesn't cause us any more problems.
You know, Martin, I'm looking at the photo of the remains of the computer that held the files leaked by Snowden that were destroyed. I mean, this is kind of surreal. They're sort of black and charred. If this happened on Tuesday, I mean, why isn't this leading national news?
Well, it certainly was in the UK for a few days. It was it got a lot of pickup there, as you'd imagine it would. I've looked at those photos as well, and, The Guardian have just been to a viewing of the WikiLeaks film, which has been made about Assange and others, and of course that featured Guardian executives, including Rusbridge. But I couldn't help but think that this episode, cutting up laptops and hard drives in the basement under supervision of spooks, would be a far better film. And so I'd be looking forward to see what becomes of this downriver.
Protop, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, this is not receiving national headlines in the United States.
Well, I think certainly mainstream newspapers in the United States are a little annoyed that The Guardian has scooped them on what should be, of course, their story, but of course will not be because they have been very careful not to upset the powers that be. I mean, you have to understand that in the 300 stories The Guardian has published, The Washington Post, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal have not exactly covered themselves with glory. The Post has a few stories, but it's fairly clear that Snowden gave them the documents in order to make sure that there was that they got coverage in the United States, but not because he trusted the Post as having to do a good story. So I think they have tried to avoid pointing too much to the Guardian because it doesn't reflect very well on themselves.
Hmm. Kevin, do you agree with that? Is that why we're not seeing as much coverage here?
I think that's fair. I would acknowledge a story that was published by the New York Times public editor, Margaret Sullivan, which I found to be kind of peculiar. I usually like much of what Margaret writes, and I was wondering if somebody had instructed her to write this story, because it seems to go to great lengths to make it appear that the New York Times has done the best coverage of the NSA stories since they were broken by The Guardian and The Washington Post, which is kind of odd because I don't think of the New York Times when I'm thinking of the NSA stories that have been published. I think about Glenn Greenwald and The Guardian, and I think about the people who continue to report with the sources and everything. But so I do think that there is some animosity towards the fact that they were scooped. I do think that media organizations are trying to come to grips with this reality that there are more and more sources out there that are willing to go to non-traditional media organizations. But I know The Guardian isn't one of those, but they are grasping with this issue because Manning needed to go to WikiLeaks, and then you got Snowden thinking, I want to go to Glenn Greenwald, who had been previously associated with Salon and had been previously associated as an independent blogger before joining The Guardian.
Right. Well, and before we move on to Syria, since you brought up these issues, Martin, I also wanted you all to comment on what happened last Sunday when Glenn Greenwald's partner, David Miranda, was held in detention for 9 hours. He was questioned under a provision of Britain's terrorism laws after he was stopped as he changed planes on his way home from Berlin to Brazil. So it was a layover in the UK. Authorities took his electronic equipment, his mobile phone, his laptop, memory card, DVDs, game consoles, and demanded his passwords. First off, Martin, why did the UK government do this, knowing that this was going to get so much media attention?
Well, I think it falls back into the general prism of getting a lot of heat from the NSA, which is a client of GCHQ. They have a very, very cooperative relationship, and they have done for many, many years. They both need each other, but perhaps GCHQ needs the NSA a little bit more. Now, the British government have been shifting uncomfortably in their seats for many months now as these Snowden revelations trickle on out in our pages and also in the pages of the Washington Post and others. They were of a view that Miranda had been sent by the Guardian to go and see Laura Poitras in Berlin, who had received Laura was a co-collaborator on the early Snowden story. She was a video maker, and she was certainly taken into trust by Snowden as much as Greenwald was. So David Miranda had been to see her, and he had received some data from her that she had apparently received from Snowden. Miranda's name was on a watch list. The Brits decided to do something about it by using a power that is only available to them to exercise airside, in other words, not past the border. This power of 9 hours detention is without access to a lawyer is only able for them to exercise in the transit area of the terminal, and it's designed specifically to go after terrorism offences, and that's the issue. That's the preeminent issue here. What happened within the spirit of the anti-terrorism laws or the spirit of the act as it was intended? The person who drafted that particular act says not. So it was a very contentious decision, and it was made in the prism of we just can't let these things roll on and continue to embarrass us forevermore. And, you know, our stakeholding partners are getting very upset about it, and we're not happy either.
An injunction was recently released which blocks the UK government from using or sharing material seized from David Miranda at the Heathrow Airport. Protop, you've written about the GCHQ. What does this say about journalism? I mean, a lot of people were kind of surprised. I think Glenn Greenwald may have been surprised by this because he has said that he might ask for protection from the Brazilian government if he decides to leave the country. But I don't know if he was surprised by them asking his partner for 9 hours or holding his partner for 9 hours. But what does this say about journalism?
I think it's incredibly worrying because it means that, you know, they can and will go after people just as they went after, you know, just as they grounded Evo Morales' plane on the suspicion that Edward Snowden was on it, is they will stop at nothing to intimidate in particular. And in some ways, I think this is silly. It is really forcing The Guardian to smash computers, arresting David Miranda, forcing Evo Morales' plane down, you know, are sort of the acts of a bully. It's not actually clever, or it may intimidate certain individuals into stopping what they're doing. Clearly is not going to do that to Glenn Greenwald. And I think if they took a step back and thought about it, they would realize that Edward Snowden came forward and gave his name despite what had happened to Bradley Manning and to Julian Assange. So it's, in fact, if they thought about it carefully, I think they would realize that, in fact, this is, in fact, may encouraged other people to come forward. The Obama administration has carried out an unprecedented war on whistleblowers, and yet, in fact, more people are coming forward, I think, because people are getting progressively more outraged. So in some ways, I just think it's stupidity on their part. But of course, for some people, it would be incredibly worrying. I mean, I have to think about, you know, the next time I enter Britain. Hmm. You know, even though I'm a British citizen, I could potentially be stopped at the border. And one of the interesting things about entering Britain is that if you have a hard drive, an encrypted hard drive, you are required to turn that password over. I don't think that's true in the U.S. So Miranda could have faced jail for not turning over those passwords. They were correct in saying that. Now, he could have refused and gone to jail. But remember, he's not really a journalist. So, I mean, I think he was intimidated, and that was the point.
And so there's a law on the books that requires you to hand over the passwords based on what?
Now, don't ask me about the law of that. Maybe Martin knows more about this. But there is actually a discrepancy between... So the ideal way, and in some ways, not to criticize Glenn Greenwald, they made a little bit of a mistake there. They should not have given, he should not have had the password to the drive. So when you carry a drive across borders, because I've done that in the past, if you don't have the drive, what you do not have, you cannot give up. So, but the thing, and this is in no way to criticize, again, Glenn Greenwald, is reporting in these kind of circumstances is very difficult. And most journalists are not aware. Glenn Greenwald himself was unaware of how to do what's called off-the-record conversations, which is sort of encrypted chats. So a lot of journalists are learning the hard way how to do reporting in these circumstances. And it is literally, I mean, I just went for a refresher myself with people who knew about this, is there are many ways they can tap your phone, they can crack your password. And if you don't know what you're doing, it's very easy to get tripped up and to be caught by them. I mean, David Petraeus, I mean, I just chuckled when Petraeus was caught because he used perhaps the stupidest way of communicating that I... This is what he did to convey messages to his mistress were things that, you know, went out of style for journalists 10 years ago.
That is Protap Chatterjee. He is executive director of Corp Watch. We're also joined today by Kevin Gostola, reporter with Fire Dog Lake, who's been covering Manning's trial since the beginning. And Martin Chulov is Middle East correspondent with The Guardian. And if you'd like to join us, we're going to talk about Syria in just a couple of minutes. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. We're talking about the NSA money, the NSA's budget. We're going to talk later in the show about Chelsea Manning. Bradley Manning is going to shift from Bradley to Chelsea. And so we're going to talk about coverage of his trial. And Martin, just quickly, I wonder, because of everything that's happened with The Guardian, have you seen major changes? I mean, in terms of the mood, the reporting, you know, what has this explosive story done to this institution?
Well, I don't think it's done us any harm in terms of trying to get a toehold in the US, which has been a cornerstone of the expansion strategy over the last year or so. I think the exposure there has been terrific. And I do think that you know, positionally, we are seen as an organization that doesn't cower to power, that isn't necessarily anti-establishment, but nor does it have too many establishment friends. I do think that, you know, having an independent, strident, sometimes campaigning voice is where the organization wants to be positioned. And I think that this has certainly reinforced the brand in many ways. It's, you know, in all my time with the newspaper, I haven't experienced it being talked about as much as it is now. And, you know, everywhere I go in the Middle East, the NSA stories are brought up, as is our Arab Spring coverage at the moment. So I think by and large, it hasn't done us any harm.
Well, let's talk about what's happening in Syria. On Wednesday, according to many reports, we've seen videos, horrific photos. More than 1,000 people were killed, allegedly, by chemical weapons. But as is the case often with Syria, no one knows who did it or what exactly happened. So how do you report on this? I mean, you can't physically go to Syria. What do you make of what exactly happened?
We came to Syria, and I have been there a lot in the last year or so, but it's mostly to the opposition-held areas, because to get to Damascus, the scene of this attack, we do need a visa. And despite 6 applications for a visa, one of which is pending at the moment, we still haven't had any success with that. So in order to cover the regime side of things, it is rather tricky, as you say. And how do you go about covering a story as contentious as this? I think the starting point is pretty basic, and that is the basic facts. And let's just look at the circumstances that took place Wednesday night your time, Thursday morning Syria time. By their own admission, the Syrian military were advancing into the eastern part of Damascus. It was, as by their admission, the biggest military operation they'd launched at any point in the last 2.5 years. The region they were targeting was called Eastern Ghouta, which is basically the eastern third of the capital. The center of the city is basically secure. It's where the presidential palace, the security establishment, the halls of power all are. There's been a few car bombs get in there, the occasional mortar, but by and large, life has gone on. It's not the case in the east, which is absolutely rebel-held and has been for the past year or so, with a deadly sort of a stalemate in between, the regime unable to advance and the opposition unable to advance. So we do know that a very large military operation was taking place at the time. If you look at the videos, I think rather than take everything on face value, even if you do accept, as I do, that the scenes that were depicted were not theatre, these were people in scenes of respiratory distress, many of whom were dying. These were people in great anguish and suffering from, you know, severe emotional trauma. Now, rather than, you know, race into print with preliminary assessments such as that, we have consulted far and wide with chemical weapons experts, with neurological experts, with biological weapons experts and others, all sorts of physicians who have drawn their own professional conclusions that what was depicted was indeed real, that this was not acting. We then look at the symptoms. What do they show? And there's a growing body of evidence, not conclusive yet, but certainly world-renowned chemical weapons experts are starting to put their name to an assertion, I should say, that sarin was indeed used. So then I guess we do what any basic form of reporting would start with, and that is speak to eyewitnesses, as many as we can.
And Martin, on that note, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue talking about how the media are covering the alleged chemical weapons attack in Syria. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
All the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable on Your Call are posted at yourcallradio.org, and we invite you to highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll talk about how web-based crowdsourcing platforms are changing the fundraising landscape for artists. Kickstarter now raises more money for artists than the National Endowment for the Arts. So how are these sites filling the gaps at a time when major foundations and the government have greatly reduced their funding for the arts? That's Monday. Tuesday, we'll talk about how young people are falling out of love with the automobile. According to a recent study by U.S. PIRG, rejection of car culture is here to stay. It's led by millennials who don't have the romance with the car that their parents and grandparents have. So how are attitudes and behaviors changing when it comes to driving? That's on Tuesday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. We're going to talk about coverage of Bradley Manning, who's now Chelsea Manning. We'll talk about her trial and sentence to 35 years in military prison with Kevin Gostola, reporter with Fire Dog Lake. He's been covering the trial since the beginning. Prochop Chatterjee, executive director of Corp Watch, is here, and we'll talk with him about NSA's budget and funding and companies that most of us have probably never heard of. And we're talking now with Martin Chulov, Middle East correspondent with The Guardian, about what is happening in Syria. And Martin, you were talking about, you know, relying on scientists, relying on eyewitness reports to report on what actually happened when you're not physically in Syria. And the other thing that is interesting, and, you know, with every other massacre that's happened in Syria, the situation often gets internationalized, and it basically becomes the U.S. and Europe versus Iran, Russia, and China. And that dominates the news cycle. I mean, how do you go about telling the story when you have so many major players involved in this?
Well, that's right. It is difficult. It's certainly the most challenging coverage that I've been involved in my 19 years as a reporter. But I think the way around that is just not to let the, you know, I guess the heat, the disputed narrative, the contest for what's right and what's wrong, really in the way of just staying fact-based. Mm. And, you know, I do think that all of those things that I discussed before, the eyewitnesses, the scientists, an innate sense of the societies, that's very important as well. I mean, an expertise from covering the region that you really can't put a price on it. It just comes from just getting a sense of what is right and what is wrong, and that's you're very often tested with that, certainly in Syria, where you are quite often, certainly in the regime side of things, reporting remotely. It's certainly not perfect. I wish I was there. I would do anything to be there, but I can't get there, and nor can most of my colleagues.
And Kevin, before we let Martin go, do you have any questions for him about Syria and reporting?
Well, I would just ask if he has felt any pressures because of certain U.S. policy to, you know, cover a certain way, or if you've felt any sort of other external pressures, maybe from Russia, to report on something a certain way?
I wouldn't say from Russia or the U.S., but, you know, there is a constituency among our readership that is very much center-left or even hard-left that does see the world through anti-imperialistic eyes, or certainly see the region through, I shouldn't say anti, I should say imperialistic eyes. There's a significant constituency that sees what is taking place as being part of an American plot to arm jihadists to oust Assad, because Assad is, as they see it, a cornerstone of resistance against Israel. Mm. Now, you know, we get heavied on that a lot. And again, I just come back to, we have a commentary section of the organization of The Guardian, which is very robust and publishes a broad range of views on that. We let them do our thing. It doesn't interfere with our reporting. And, you know, we're thick-skinned enough and confident enough in our own news gathering to report as we see it.
I've seen this all over Facebook. I mean, this seems to have helped create a number of narratives about this conflict.
Yeah, you mean the anti-imperialism thing?
Yes, exactly. And basically placing all the blame or saying that it's all about the U.S. Once the U.S. stops arming, then this will end. That's the narrative that we're hearing.
Well, that's right. And by any objective, the Americans don't want to play. They really don't. And it's very, very clear. I spend a lot of time in Turkey, in Syria, speaking to, you know, diplomats, all sorts of folks about the, you know, we get a very panoramic view in this line of work. And there isn't any sign that the Americans are really pushing this hard. To the contrary, they wish it would go away. They're still wounded by the legacy of Iraq, which was a strategic failure by any test. I mean, $750 billion was spent on that. And what was the sole strategic goal? And that was to hand over the heartland of Arabia to your worst enemy, Iran. So they're not rushing to get back into another misadventure in a sectarian state next door. The Americans aren't pushing it hard, although they are giving tacit approval to the Saudis and the Qataris, a bit more so in recent months, actually, than before, to go ahead and do their own thing.
And Protop, do you have any questions for Martin before he says goodbye?
Well, I am really curious. There are efforts by the Syrian National Council, I think, to organize in Cairo. And, of course, there are U.S. training outfits, I think, both in Jordan and in Turkey, if I'm not wrong. There have been reports, isolated reports over the last couple of years of U.S. military advisors. How easy is it to report on that? And I'm not suggesting any way that the U.S. is sending arms in as the imperialist argument goes, but there is certainly an advisory role that's being played with the SNC in particular and with other entities involved. And I feel like there needs to be a little more reporting on that.
Well, that's totally true. I agree with what you say. They are certainly trying to shape a civilian alternative to Assad via funding an organization of primarily expat Syrians who they hope will be able to form some form of cohesive command and control over so many disparate militias in the country, including jihadists, a growing number of them who are very influential. They are trying to position an alternative, if indeed that can be done, but with very little success. And in terms of the opposition groups that they are training, that's true as well. There are scores of them, no more than that, and they all report to a Free Syria Army commander called Salam Idris. He could effectively claim control over less than 5% of the militia groups operating inside of the country at the moment. And we saw this week, Martin Dempsey release a letter to a Republican congressman explaining the reasons for the Pentagon not wanting to get too involved, and that was that they could not identify people who they were confident in reflecting their worldview downriver, and that they don't think that anybody that they've ever tried to empower can call the shots in the country. So while I don't dispute that the Americans are dabbling and they certainly are trying to create an alternative, they're not trying hard. This is not part of a push. This is just, efforts on the sidelines to get something going that so far have been spectacularly unsuccessful.
Somewhat like in Libya.
Like in Libya, Martin?
In Libya, it's slightly different. I mean, it was quite easy to take down Gaddafi. He was almost the caricature of a perfect villain. He treated everybody abominably, and he had no friends.
So the Americans
gave cover to NATO for 3 weeks, command and control cover. Well, NATO and Britain went in and bombed everything, but that was a very limited sort of mandate, and then they sort of walked away from it.
So, no, that I'm referring to is the aftermath of jockeying for control, the different groups jockeying for control, and the Americans wishing that they actually had more power after the fall of Gaddafi.
Yeah, I think that's right. But they would also point to Libya, and they do this in private circles, as saying, well, look what happens when you remove an autocrat from a tightly controlled society for so long. We can't control the aftermath, and they're using that as a reason to not take a heavier stake in Syria.
Well, Martin, thank you as always so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you. That is Martin Chulov. He is the Middle East correspondent for The Guardian, joining us from Cairo, and he has been reporting extensively on the tragedies that are happening in Syria. You can find his reporting at yourcallradio.org. And today it's our media roundtable, and joining us for the rest of the hour, Protop Chatterjee, executive director of CorpWatch. He's been covering NSA funding. His latest piece focuses on Glimmer Glass. This is a Northern California company that sells optical fiber technology to government agencies. So we'll talk talk about the companies that are making money off of spying. And then Kevin Gostola is a reporter with Fire Dog Lake, and he's been covering Chelsea Manning's trial since the very beginning. Manning was sentenced to 35 years in military prison on Tuesday. On the day after the sentencing, Bradley announced in a letter that he wants to live as a woman and is now Chelsea. And Kevin, you know, we've noticed that so much of the media coverage, I mean, this is really not that surprising, but it's shifted from Chelsea being a whistleblower and the details of the leaks to everything is about gender identity now. What are you seeing and what strikes you about the coverage after Bradley Manning made the Chelsea announcement?
Well, first, I would contest that it was ever about whether Manning was a whistleblower, because I just don't think that there was a legitimate conversation about that, in actually assessing the fact that we have all of these revelations, and without getting into specifics, you've got these, you know, general issues of war crimes and torture being presented, diplomatic misconduct, and let's talk about the nature of what's being exposed, and let's really bring forward what the benefit is going to be to human rights groups and even some international bodies in the world that have used this information. And so now with this announcement, I don't fault Manning. I don't think that it's fair to suggest that the announcement is shifting away from important issues because Manning decided to make this announcement. I've actually heard this in response to what I've been writing about this announcement. And I also would just add that I think that it's really shameful that the media won't just go ahead and start using she to describe Manning and won't accept the Chelsea because, and maybe it's because they don't understand the issues because some of them weren't following it as closely as I did and chose not to be interested, but this is actually not unusual to me. I could have seen this and expected it, that Manning would announce. I wasn't expecting to hear an announcement the day after she was sentenced to 35 years in prison. But I know because of the gender confusion or gender identity disorder issues that came forward and what was going on in the history of Manning, that eventually there was going to be a situation at Fort Leavenworth where some kind of treatment was going to be sought, and there was going to be a conflict between Manning and the prison and the Pentagon over getting hormone therapy or some kind of transgender treatment.
So when you look at the details of WikiLeaks and the information that she leaked, what happens to that information now that this trial is over, specifically media coverage?
That is the key question. I think it's up to journalists like myself and others who still find value in it to maybe revisit or continue to use it. It now becomes largely historical. As long as people aren't plugging it into databases and searching. There was a while where you were seeing WikiLeaks tables referenced in international news stories because there was still information in it that could provide great background for developments around the world. I think that's still the case. I think that there are still things happening around the world. For example, possibly Syria, which we just spent some time talking about, where you could go into tables and use background information there to supplement developing news stories. I think this still has a value, but then it becomes historical. People who are out there should start to show others, maybe through books, less in the news, but maybe publishing books or putting up projects online that people can access so they can really see that the information that Manning has been sentenced to 35 years in prison for really is beneficial to the world. I have to say, from being there, no experience of hearing any actual examples of harm or damage presented in open court. And if there was any real examples, his lawyer contests this, says in the closed session, nothing real damaging or harmful was presented. But and that's a biased person, obviously. But, the decent thing would have been to declassify at least one or two or three real examples if the government thinks they have something, so you and I could have this conversation today and others around the world could talk about whether it was reasonable to be sentenced to 35 years in prison.
Protap, what are your thoughts on this? Because, I was just searching and it looks like, you know, most of the coverage is about Chelsea Manning and gender identity. I mean, what happens to WikiLeaks and the information that was exposed about everything from Fukushima to Haiti? I mean, there's just so much, such a wide range of information that was exposed. What happens to that now?
Well, the people are still using it. I mean, there was an article, actually, I think 2 days ago, in fact, 3 days ago, sorry, in the New York Times, called, the title was Cairo Military Firmly Hooked to U.S. Lifeline, where, in fact, the reporter went back into the cables and discovered this information. Now a lot of people are probably aware that Egypt has a very strong relationship with the United States, partly, I think, to defend Israel, but also because it's very beneficial to the generals that are now controlling and have always controlled Egypt. But the reporter Eric Schmidt actually went back into WikiLeaks documents and found something from the U.S. Embassy explaining that this, you know, the government itself had internally accepted that this was the point of giving money to the Egyptian military. So some information is being used. It's a drip. It's historical. Of course, when the original cables came out, the Afghan cables, the Iraq cables, the State Department cables, they were relatively recent. So this was 2010 that they started to come out, and they were reporting on data that was as recent as 9 months prior. So now, of course, because it's 4 years in the past, it will eventually become mostly a historical record. Having said that, there's a lot of other things that WikiLeaks has released, and I think it's forever difficult for Julian that people focus so much on him, on the trial of Chelsea Manning, as opposed to on the issues that he has really tried to push forward. And in fact, in the last week, if you follow WikiLeaks' Twitter feed, he's been pushing out information on Stratfor and their internal emails on Africa and that sort of thing, which has gotten no pickup at all. So the government has effectively marginalized Julian. The government has effectively marginalized Bradley Manning and Chelsea Manning. And now they're attempting to do that with Snowden, is to really focus, and the media plays into this, is focus on, you know, Edward Snowden's father and all this other stuff, as to about the real issues, which is, what is the NSA doing? Mm. What did the Bush administration doing? What is the Obama administration doing?
I actually just want to read a quick email about Fukushima. Valerie writes in and says, can you please spend some time talking about Fukushima and the disaster? We're actually going to do a show about Fukushima in the coming weeks. There's so much new information. Just to read you a few headlines, BBC, Fukushima leak is much worse than we were led to believe. Guardian, Fukushima warning, danger level at nuclear plant jumps to serious. So we're going to be doing a show about Fukushima soon, so be sure to tune in for that. And thank you for the email, Valerie. And let's hear from Kelly in Oakland on the NSA. Hi, Kelly.
I've been listening to your show over the weeks about the NSA, and I worked in the computer industry way back when Bill Gates was starting Microsoft, and he was competing with another company, Digital Research, to have the first operating system on IBM computers. And there was always a rumor in the industry that he got the deal because the NSA wanted to put a trap door in the operating system. And recently, I read an article in a magazine in Santa Cruz puts out called Connection, where a guy in Europe, a crypto company, went through the code at a very minor level, minute level, and found the actual NSA trap door in the Microsoft operating system, which leads one to believe Bill Gates has made a billionaire because the NSA told IBM to please, to accept what was basically, you know, a crappy operating system as far as the industry thought. And he rose to power, it's assumed, by his buddy climbing in bed with the NSA. So the question is, did Steve and Steve do the same thing at Apple? You know, I mean, have we had trapdoors all along, maybe?
Well, Protop, how do you get your hands on this kind of information, or can you?
Very, very difficult. I mean, what's interesting is that, first of all, with Apple, and I use Apple products a lot, but it's a closed operating system which is owned by Apple, and they decide what goes in and what goes out. You cannot, unlike, let's say, Linux or something, where the code is open to anybody to inspect. So if, let's say, Steve Jobs, and I assume the second Steve you're talking about is Steve Ballmer, of the current CEO of Microsoft, if they had arrangements with the NSA Well, it would be extremely easy for them to work with Apple. And I'm not saying that I know anything, because I don't. But it's also a matter of public record. There's actually an excellent series coming out in the next issue of Forbes about a company called Palantir and its role with form and the companies that are financed by the CIA. There's an entity called Incutel in Silicon Valley that gives money to computer companies to develop software and to sell products. This is not actually a conspiracy. It is a fact that the CIA itself pretty much acknowledges is that they provide funding. And this is also true of not just the U.S. government. It's presumably true of the British government. It is most certainly true of the Israeli government, which there's a unit called Unit 8200, which finances Israeli companies. Naris is a very good example. A company that whose technology was used to tap, whose hardware was used at the AT&T offices in San Francisco by Mark Klein to, which Mark Klein revealed to tap American telephone calls.
So, can I ask another question?
Yeah.
Doesn't this go back to Promise Software in the Insula case when they put the originally the government took the software over? And now we have a version of this all over, you know, the total awareness kind of grew out of that too?
Well, here's the thing is it gets complicated. I will say that I've been very skeptical of a lot of conspiracy theories, and in the last few months in particular, I've had to eat my words when I've realized that, in fact, a lot of what people have said about the NSA was, in fact, true. So sometimes, of course, the fine details of exactly how they did it or who funded them or what kind of latitude they got is really hard to determine. But it is certainly true there has been a long relationship between the NSA, the CIA, groups like Unit 8200 in Israel that have worked with companies in Silicon Valley. And I really urge people to read this because it's in the next issue of Forbes. I think it's the September 3rd issue. Because this is not coming from CorpWatch or Connection in Santa Cruz, but from the heart of business, which is saying, yes, absolutely, we work with the intelligence community in developing the software, and they funded. There's a really good piece, actually, in I think today's New York Times by Soumini Sengupta, which also speaks of how the NSA funds people in colleges. So let's say you're an undergrad. They will give you a scholarship. When you leave college, you have to go work for the NSA for 4 years. And once you've done your 4 years, you get to go off and do a startup, and they will help you.
So wow.
There's no conspiracy here. It's true. they admit it, and they pay for people in college.
Oh. Business Week also has a piece on how much public funds companies are getting from the NSA, and it's reporting that Booz Allen Hamilton has received almost $5.8 billion just this year alone. And we'll put this infographic on our site right after the show. Thank you for calling in. Let's go to Ken in San Francisco. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the show.
You touched on it already while I've been on hold here, but maybe it deserves to be underlined. Is there a lesson for future leakers? I mean, I'm just comparing Julian Assange of WikiLeaks, Eric Snowden, and Mr. Manning compared with Deep Throat. Clearly, staying anonymous prevents the media and prevents the character assassination of the person leaking and their family members by staying silent. So really it is a strategic error in terms of getting the word out to put a face to the leak. Any comments about that?
Well, that's a very good question, and you know, I struggle with it myself. But, I mean, the problem is when a whistleblower comes forward, let's say, to the Guardian newspaper or to CorpWatch, you know, it will be dismissed by everybody as being, you know, just, you know, an angry person who perhaps didn't get a raise or some such thing. Just remember that Edward Snowden is not the first person to come forward from the NSA. Bill Binney, Ed Loomis, Thomas Drake, Russ Tice. There are a number of them who've come forward and said what they said. But what Snowden did was he also gave the documents, which made it very... And by coming forward, you have to remember that before Snowden said who he was and proved that these documents were accurate, there were a lot of people saying, well, how do we know that this is not something that somebody altered, you know? So it is a very, very, very difficult situation for whistleblowers. And I take my hat off to the Chelsea Mannings, Edward Snowdens, and the Bill Binneys of the world who've come forward and given us the documents and helped us. I would urge, of course, people to be very careful about if there are whistleblowers listening or people want to talk about this, whether they're talking about San Francisco, Oakland, or the NSA or whatever, is to learn how to protect themselves by, you know, going to groups like... in San Francisco, there's a group that can teach you about how to use technology safely. It's called Aspiration Technology.
You know, sorry to cut you off. We're almost out of time. We should do a show about that. That's a great idea. Kevin, we've got about 30 seconds left. Your final thoughts on our last caller?
Well, I think that there's a big issue because the Obama administration has not made it possible, I think, for whistleblowers from intelligence or national security agencies to come forward. And I don't think that there are proper ways that military whistleblowers can come forward. So that's the thing. Bradley Manning and Edward Snowden stand out as really classic whistleblowers, and you have to laud them because of the pressures that are there internally, and there's no other way for them to really do what they have done. Bradley Manning would have been shut down if he went to his superiors holding information and said, I think this needs to be released. He just would have lost his security clearance, and we never would have seen the information.
You mean Chelsea Manning?
Chelsea, I apologize.
No, it's all right. We actually got a caller who said, can you please call Bradley Chelsea? Yes, it might take a couple days for it to sink in, but it's Chelsea Manning, and we will say she from now on. Thank you for that call. And thank you so much, Kevin and Protop. Kevin Gostola is a reporter with Fire Dog Lake, covering Chelsea Manning's trial from the beginning. Protop Chatterjee is executive director of Corp Watch. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. How are web-based crowdsourcing platforms changing the fundraising landscape? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about what it means for artists and musicians who are funding their projects through various crowdsourcing sites. Kickstarter now raises more money for artists than the National Endowment for the Arts. So how are artists pitching their projects? What actually works? And how are these sites filling the gaps at a time when foundations and the government have reduced funding for the arts? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulip is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
I try my best to look artsy, to fit in. Even though I'm not wearing pearls, they are emblazoned on my chest.
Tune in for more true stories told live. Old-fashioned storytelling about modern life. Next time on the Moth Radio Hour. From the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
You can catch The Moth here on KLW on Sunday evenings at 6, right after Selected Shorts. At 5, Selected Shorts, the stories will be Cathedral by Raymond Carver, read by James Naughton, and I Dated Jane Austen by T.C. Boyle, read by Isaiah Sheffer. Cynthia Nixon is guest host this week for Selected Shorts Sunday at 5. This is Local Public Radio, KLW, San Francisco. The time is 11 o'clock.
Hello, I'm Chloe Tilley. Welcome to World Have Your Say. And Syria's children are paying the price for the conflict.
Last year, around this time, we had 70,000 Syrian refugee children. Today, we have reached 1 million.
Figures from the UN show the enormity of the problem. It says another 2 million children are displaced in their own country. But what does it mean to be a refugee? Over the next hour, you'll hear the harrowing and moving stories of Syrian refugees who've left their homes to seek safety in neighbouring countries. And as a photojournalist is gang-raped in Mumbai, we'll speak to Indian women to see if anything has changed in the last 8 months since the rape and murder of a woman on a Delhi bus. You can get in touch using the hashtag WHYS.